Okay, I'm delighted to say I'm joined on the programme now by Anne-Marie Doherty. Anne-Marie, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
It's very good to chat to you again. How are you?
We're doing very well, so we are.
Fantastic. And you're speaking to us from Ireland, are you?
I am. Back home.
Superb. Well, we'll get to that. Remind people of Paul's story, because you went public with it, didn't you?
We did. We went public because Paul was born with a spastic quadriplegic cerebral palsy, and really his future life meant that he would be confined to a wheelchair. He wouldn't be able to do a lot of everyday things by himself, like cook or use the bathroom, have a shower, you know, go to the shops, because he would be confined to the wheelchair.
And you were, sorry, Anne-Marie, you were left in that awful situation whereby there was treatment available for Paul, but it was out of your reach.
It was. Unfortunately, the treatment that Paul needed was in America. We did try the various options here in Ireland. Like, we've done, you know, the treatments that were available in Ireland, and I even asked about this operation. Could we get this operation for Paul in Ireland? And, you know, I met with what I thought was the specialist in Ireland when Paul was, believe it or not, only two or three. And, you know, within a six-minute appointment, he turned around and said, no, Paul wasn't suitable. And, you know, when I think back in that now, that's hard, you know.
But you could have given up then, Anne-Marie.
I could have given up.
I mean, you could have said, OK, a specialist has told me this, we're going to readjust our life and move forward, but you didn't let it go.
I probably would have, but the fact was that when we did go up to Dublin, I had already forwarded all of Paul's information, and the key thing was an MRI scan. And when we went in for the appointment, the doctor just told me, said, I'm sorry, I couldn't open the scan. And he just made his decision based on that six-minute appointment. And do you know this? If he had opened the scan and said then that Paul wasn't suitable, I probably would have left it. But that, you know, was a key turning point for me. Like, I mean, that somebody could make this decision for Paul based on such a short meeting with Paul.
A life, I mean, it's literally a life-changing decision. Now, you did research, you found out Paul could travel to America for this operation, but it would cost around €60,000. For the vast majority of us, that is completely unattainable, even through loans or what have you. So you turned to the public and, I mean, you were overwhelmed with the response.
Just amazed. Like, I mean, people I don't know would phone me, would send messages. I would get checks in the post for Paul. People would have rung up doing fundraising events for Paul. The fund that was always called Mammy, I Want to Walk. Mm. And I think that really, you know, touch people's heartstrings a wee bit, because they could imagine probably their own children saying that. Mm. And that's exactly what Paul would have said. From he could learn to talk, Mammy, I want to walk.
And you never want to say, Paul, that can't happen. You want to do everything you can to ensure it does happen.
We did a lot of research on it, Greg, and you know, we found the operation in America, and we sent off the scans and all the x-rays and all of Paul's medical history, you know, to America.
Right. Moving forward then, you travelled out to America. Paul underwent the operations. Was it a terrible strain on him, Anne-Marie, or?
Do you know this, Greg? It wasn't.
Really?
Brilliant. It really wasn't. He ended up having to have two operations. We thought it was just one, but when we got out there, then we found out it was two. Mm. And the character of Paul, he just took it in his stride. You know, he woke up and, you know, he was in good, all right, he was a bit sick from anaesthetic. He was quite sick from anaesthetic, but that would have been a natural reaction. Mm. But, you know, every day, you know, he was playing, the therapy dogs used to come in. He was in such good form. And Paul's a smiler, and he smiled the whole way through it and laughed and giggled and had the crack with the nurses and the doctors and everything.
Charming them, I'm sure, was he?
Oh, it was. You know, and it made things a lot easier for myself and Michael as well.
But if you see your child happy, it takes some pressure off you, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
So, you get Paul home. Obviously, you know, you can never be sure how these things pan out, but I heard that he's been standing up and everything.
He's standing up, he is.
Oh, my God.
He's standing up. He can now sit on the floor by himself, which he wasn't able to do. He sits at an ordinary table, on an ordinary chair. He no longer uses kind of the specialist feet that he would have had.
He can support his upper body, sort of a thing.
Support his upper body. He eats, drinks, plays, everything, you know, like anybody else would do sitting at a table. Mm. You know, he's in no pain. He sleeps now all night, and that's a huge thing.
Yep.
You know, Paul never slept all night until this operation, and now everybody's getting a night's sleep, you know. you know, when he stands up, he's so straight. you know, he's getting stronger every day. You know, even his concentration has improved.
Yeah, I was going to ask about his mood. I'd say, you know, children handle stress in different ways, don't they? And they may not show it like we would. But I presume he seems happier as well in himself.
He's so happy because he doesn't have to think about his body as much about, as it, am I safe here in this position or whatever, you know. He's a lot happier that, and he's so proud when he's achieved something new. You know, he said to me the last day, it was so funny, "Mommy, come in with the camera." You know, he wanted me to take a photograph of what he'd achieved. And then, you know, he'd say, "Did I get it?" And I'd show him the photograph of the video to make sure that I got it. You know, he's just, you know, he's hilarious.
What progress can you look forward to then, Anne-Marie?
Well, you know, we've had such a huge progress so far. I'm nearly, you know, afraid to jinx it because I don't...
Well, don't. Look, we won't. He's doing fantastic. We won't do it. He's doing fantastic. And what we'll do is we'll check back you in the future and see what happens. And he can set his own targets rather than us doing it on the radio for him. I just wanted to bring you back on, Anne-Marie, because, as I say, you know, the community responded. It's like we're all involved, so...
Yeah. Even today, Greg, there's or on Monday, there's 105 local people doing the Belfast City Marathon for Paul.
Wow.
You know, that's people who mightn't have run last Christmas, and they're, you know what I mean, they're out now doing a marathon or a leg of a marathon, and they're actually having a collection in the town in Belfast earlier today for them. And I'd also need to mention that we have been able to bring over Isabella. Isabella would be a specialist conductor and conductive education, which is an all-round program for Paul. And it, you know, it's through her that Paul is achieving so much. And I keep telling everybody it's a 2-year program. And, you know, if Paul continues as he is, who knows what will happen.
Well, I think you deserve a massive chunk of the credit to Anne-Marie and everyone else involved. It's a really positive story. I see a picture of him here. He is happy as Larry, you can tell.
Yeah.
And onwards and upwards. Anne-Marie, it's been a great speaking to you. And the collection buckets are out in the Twin Towns if people want to help. And as you mentioned, there's people running the marathon on Monday and what have you.
Yeah, thanks very much.
All right, God bless you, Anne-Marie.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Joined in studio now for some live music by Karen Kelly, a local singer-songwriter. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're nice and fresh. A lot of musicians come in here a bit weary looking on a Saturday morning because they're gigging the night before, but not you.
No, I'm playing tonight though, so we'll see what the crack is tomorrow.
Excellent. Well, I'm not here tomorrow. I think Mass is on. You can come in for that.
Yeah.
Karen, tell us a little bit about yourself. You primarily play with the Ruby Ragdolls. Is that a two-piece, is it?
Yeah, that's a two-piece. Me and Sean McDade. We're actually playing tonight in Dylan's Hotel.
Lovely.
From 10:30, and we'll be in the Barca Bar on the 9th of May. So
next what kind of stuff do you play?
It's just covers and that. Like, it's kind of upbeat stuff, you know.
Good.
Not like what I'm going to do now.
And is it not like what you're going to do now? You can do two. And what do you, when you're doing covers, do you sort of stay loyal to the covers, or do you try and put your own spin on it or whatever?
And there's a few ones we kind of put our own stamp on.
Yeah, there's no harm in that.
Yeah.
And also you play with a few other outfits, don't you?
Yeah, when I'm doing my own stuff, I play with Sam McCafferty.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually playing a few songs now this afternoon down in the Market Square for the Save the Church Lane.
Oh, lovely.
Fundraisers. So.
We had them on not so long ago either.
Oh, right, okay. Cool. So Sam and I will be playing a few songs down at that.
Excellent. And as it relates to your own music, I presume that's your real passion, is it?
My original?
Yeah.
Pretty open mind, you know, kind of do a bit of everything.
Yeah, I suppose you have to, because you have to pay the bills as well as everything else, don't you? So, listen, you're going to play us a song, and we'll chat a bit more afterwards. What are you going to sing for us?
It's one of my own ones. It's a newish one called Wounds.
Okay, take it away.
Thank you. Don't be afraid of what you feel. take the burn over the pain of letting you in again. It's a constant battle, looking down a loaded barrel. I'm letting go. I can't take you with me where I wanna go. You'd lay me down in the ground and let him go. Giving in is easy. Giving up's what frees me. I don't have to let you in. And my heart's not breaking, taking chances you're not taking. I'm letting go. I can't take you.
Karen Kelly there, that was fantastic, Karen.
Thank you.
Was that drawn from personal experience?
Yeah, it's kind of ultimately about trying to be a good person.
Semi-biographical.
Yeah.
You have a fantastic voice. Not surprised that you've done some work with John O'Callaghan and our Full Tilt guys as well,
yeah.
Local guys. What did you with John O'Callaghan?
I did a track out a year or two ago called Breathe.
Right, very good.
It's actually over in Full Tilt there at the start of the year doing the jingles for Highland.
Is that you?
That's me. Oh my god.
Fantastic. You should have sang them there. Oh, you did sing them. Brilliant. Excellent. That's interesting. And where to though? Because you seem to be going in so many different directions, if you know what I mean. Where do you want to be in a year, 2 years, 3 years artistically?
Yeah, well, I'd like to work on an EP. I mean, Simon Cafferty are working on a wee project at the minute, so
yeah.
We're middle of writing now, so we're hoping
fantastic
to get stuff.
And we've seen with Little Lars, we were speaking to them earlier on, that you can just break through and next thing you know, you hit the big time. You're already doing fantastic, don't get me wrong, but the broader the audience that can hear your stuff that you spend your time writing, I'm sure the better. Right, it's been fantastic listening to you, Karen, and chatting to you, and it's good to put a voice to the jingles.
It's my claim to fame.
Exactly. So tell us this afternoon, a few songs.
Down in Market Square, it's on from 4:30 to 6:30, and then the Ruby Rag Dolls will be from 10:30 in Dillon's tonight.
Sounds like you're going to have a fantastic day, and those who listen to you will too. Thanks so much,
Thanks
Karen,
so much,
for coming
Greg.
In.
No bother.
Okay, moving on the programme, and I'm joined on the telephone line now from France, no less, by Jennifer McLagan, who's a chef and author. Jennifer, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg.
Thank you so much for taking our call. Now, we're focusing today on the rest of the animal, and that has been your focus for some time now. Do we waste too much of what we kill for food?
I think so. I think there's a lot of parts that we just think are too much bother or they're not good to eat. You know, we're pretty concentrated on the steaks and the chops and we forget about the tongue and the kidneys and the heart and even the neck and the shanks, all of which are really delicious pieces to eat.
And perhaps in many cases more nutritious.
Yes, more nutritious and probably cheaper and a better bang for your buck, really.
But going back, at least here in Ireland, traditionally, these are parts of the animals that were utilised. But why are we moving away from it, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's true everywhere. We always used to eat these cuts of meat. I grew up eating like shanks and even brains and weirder parts. I think we somehow got lazy and, you know, we don't see them anymore. Like when we go to the supermarket to shop, all we get to see is like the loins and the chops and those cuts. And so we kind of forget that they exist. And they just get, you know, used for dog food. And that seems to be a terrible waste to me.
So then does the industry and butchers then have a responsibility to play or a role to play then?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, one big important thing is to do your meat shopping at a butcher because, you might go there with a recipe and maybe he doesn't have that cut. But all good butchers will be able to tell you which cut you can substitute. So if you can't get a shank, they'll say, well, you could make that same dish with a piece of neck meat, which will just be as delicious. And so I think it's important to go to a butcher's store and not shop in a supermarket for meat.
I think too, perhaps, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that, you know, traditionally, you know, people wouldn't bat an eyelid when you talked about tongues and cheeks and what have you. But now, you know, you ask someone in their early 20s, do they want a cow's tongue? And they may recoil.
I think they probably will because they see it as something kind of disgusting and not good to eat. But once the tongue is cooked and, of course, peeled, you take that kind of rough skin on it, you know, it's some of the best meat you can eat. You know, it makes a fabulous sandwich, or you can heat it up and have it hot on the grill. It's just super delicious. And I think the problem is we're just not familiar with those cuts anymore. So because they are unfamiliar, we think of them as being the odd bits.
And I suppose there's a bit of work to do from chefs like yourself, because particularly nowadays, you know, so much of our TV is made up of programs relating to food and chefing. And perhaps if, you know, a few high profile chefs were to start focusing on these cuts and various types of meats, well, then, you know, it condition the public to think, right, we might try that then.
I think so. I think that's important. You know, we get a lot of the information from TV, so perhaps if they had an awful challenge with, you know, famous chefs and made delicious dishes with different cuts, or, you know, if in restaurants and you went and you could try something that was a little different and you would discover how delicious the tongue salad was, and then you'd be prepared to go and make that at home.
Even though it sounds delicious when you say it. I feel like I'm going to revisit my breakfast. That's the problem, isn't it?
It is. I think
and
it's
it wasn't
really,
a tongue
really
salad.
That unfamiliarity with it. And, you know, it's surprising when you do give someone, I have a recipe for brain ravioli, you know, and brains are pretty stomach-turning for most people. But once they're put inside a little pasta case with mushrooms, it's just like eating whipped cream, flavoured whipped cream. It's super delicious.
Now, tell us about, you have a book out at the moment, don't you, which can offer people some guidance and suggestions as to what you've been describing.
Yeah, I have a book called Odd Bits, How to Cook the Rest of the Animal. And, you know, it's not all liver and kidneys. There's recipes for shank and belly and neck and, you know, things that are a little bit more familiar to lead you gently down the path. And, you know, if you get very adventurous, you can make something like blood ice cream. But I think most people will be sticking with the shanks and perhaps the steak and kidney pie.
I think as far as I may go is oxtail soup.
There you are. That's something that's delicious, right?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you as it relates to taste. And we kind of touched on it a little bit earlier. Is it comparable to you, you know, compared to the usual cuts that we used to, or is it nicer? What as someone who tastes the food before you present it, do you see it as nicer food?
I see it as sometimes a lot more flavorful. I'd rather have like an oxtail or a beef cheek than some lean cut of beef you make into a stew, because the muscles that work hard in the animal always have more flavor. And you may have to cook them a little bit longer, but you'll get tons more taste, and then you'll get a wonderful kind of unctuous sauce, you know, that has texture that is really delicious as well.
And ironically, I know you mentioned that a lot of this goes towards dog food and what have you, but we possibly are already eating a lot of this already in a very highly processed manner through some pies or what have you, things like that.
Yeah, we probably are, but that's really not, you know, it seems to me kind of a waste to do that. You know, there's nothing more delicious. I've given a lot of people a heart skewer, you know, with pieces of beef heart on it that's cooked quickly on the grill. And it's like the best piece of beef you've ever had, you know. And then when you tell people afterwards, they go, oh, that was so delicious. But if I told them it was heart beforehand. So you have to lead people over that initial aversion. And once you make them something tasty, they're pretty much converted.
It's kind of a little bit like what we do, isn't it, with for children with smoothies and what have you. You know, what you don't know doesn't hurt
you. Yeah, you put all those like nutritious things in there and blend them up.
But an adult version. And this is not like out of the reach of most people. As you've mentioned, you know, thankfully we're blessed with fantastic butchers up and down and across Ireland. A lot of these cuts would be readily available. And with the assistance of your book, you're ready to go.
Yeah, and you know the butcher and the farmer are happy for you to eat these cuts. You know, they want to sell the whole animal. They don't just want to sell the chops and the loins. So, you know, these cuts are there. So, you know, my thing is, if you're going to kill an animal to eat it, and I'm quoting a British chef here, you know, the best thing you can do is eat all of it.
Okay, sounds fantastic. And your book widely available online, I'm sure.
Yes, you can go. You can check my website. You can see it there, and it's published in the UK, so you'll be able to pick it up in Ireland as well.
Absolutely, absolutely superb. Jennifer McLagan, it's been a pleasure speaking to you.
Me too.
Bye. Lusitania, an ocean liner to rival the Titanic, on May 7th, 1915, 11 miles off the old head of Kinsale, she was struck by a single torpedo from a German U-boat. 18 minutes later, she was gone. A death toll of nearly 1,200. Who will live and who will die as the political shockwaves is felt around the world? That's the question contained within Lusitania. 18 minutes that changed the world. It's an RTE documentary which is due for broadcast. One of those who perished was John Pryor, just 25. His grandson is Damien Ternan, who is RTE's South East correspondent, and joins us on the programme now. Damien, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg. How's it going?
Very well indeed. 100 years ago, but, you know, still within living memory, at least through parents and grandparents. Tell us about your grandfather.
Yes, actually, great-grandfather, Greg.
I beg your pardon, your great-grandfather.
No problem whatsoever, yeah. No, that is absolutely, the connections are still there. He was born in Kilsyhawk in Leitrim, and in around the year 1908, maybe, he emigrated to the States, probably for economic reasons. Mm. And on his way back, he came back to Ireland then in around 1910, we're told. And on the journey home, he met a woman called Mary Ann, and they fell in love, and she was from Leitrim as well, and they got married, and they set up a house then in Leitrim. And they had two children, and then in the summer of 1914, obviously the economic times would have been extremely harsh, and they had a small little farm, so he decided he'd go back to the States to try and work for the winter. A lot of Irish people did that, it seems, if they could afford it, obviously, if they got a relatively good job, that they'd work on the land for the summer and then head over to the States for the winter. So he told Mary Ann, who was pregnant, that he'd be back the following summer. So their third child, Rose, was born then in March of 1915, and he decided he'd come home. So the journey he would come on would be the Lusitania. So it was going to be his last time coming to Ireland or leaving Ireland. He had told her that he wouldn't be going away again. So they were going to settle down with their three children. So he was a third-class passenger on the fateful ship.
And his body was never recovered.
Body was never recovered. Yeah, we understand a lot of the third class area, the accommodation, would have been where the torpedo struck. So most of the third class passengers were never recovered. And in terms of the percentage of people that survived, the third class were the largest percentage that perished and were never found. And there was obviously major efforts made by the lifeboats and different other ships down around the south.
Fishing boats and what have you.
Yeah, but My understanding is that there were bodies found, this will be in the documentary later in the week, that there were bodies found as far away as Wales, and then the tide actually brought some bodies up the Kerry coast, literally round the corner, as they say, and up the west coast of Ireland. So horrendous scenes, obviously. And
a massive national tragedy at the time.
Absolutely, yeah. So you had the national tragedy, you had the personal tragedies, you had like telegrams then going to people like my great to Mary Ann, and basically the idea that a ship had been sunk like that, and there's obviously loads of stories and controversy about.
Was it targeted, Damien?
Yeah, and were the authorities aware of it?
Yeah.
And the recent discussions are talking about that they may have been aware of it.
Well, can you tease that out a little bit for us, Damien, for those who may not be aware? What is that speculation?
Well, the speculation is that the British authorities, the Allied forces, I suppose, knew in some way that the U-boat was around there, that there was some activity, and they thought, well, if a major vessel like the Lusitania, which had so many American passengers and crew on board, if that did suffer a sinking, that it may well bring the Americans into the war and hasten the end of the war. Now, that's obviously a very cold way of looking at it, and there's no proof of that, but certainly there are a lot of conspiracy theories around about it. And
well, it's not beyond the realms of big belief, because we do know, and I think it's historically recorded, that there was intelligence that wasn't acted upon because it would alter, you know, it would give away information about what was being intercepted and what have you. So we do know things like this were allowed to happen, whether this is one of those cases or not.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. And we just, I suppose, we may never know for sure. And then we have the idea of the second explosion and possibly a third explosion on the Lusitania itself, in terms of it carrying arms. But on the personal side then, Mary Ann, she went on to marry Danny Bowen, another man in Leitrim, and they had a number of children. But my grandmother then was one of those children from the first marriage, Mary Kate, and her son then, her eldest son, would be my father, Sean, who's up in Wicklow. And I still have relations living there, Micheál Tiernan, the postman in Carrick and Shannon, and other relations then. Mary Ann's daughter, Alice, is still alive. She's living in Boyle. And her children, Jerry, I was talking to him during the week. And so the connections are quite close, in the sense that Mary Ann's daughter, Alice, as I said, she's 89 years of age. She's living in Boyle in a nursing home. She's still in good health and good spirits. And she was talking to Jerry about what her mother would have spoken about in terms of the tragedy. So it's, even though it's 100 years ago, it's only one generation.
Well, that's it. Yeah, that's the point I was trying to make at the start, because you're getting a real insight from the people who were directly involved or at least directly connected. Have you had an opportunity to see the documentary yet, Damien, or will you be watching it with the rest of us?
I'll be watching it with the rest of you, absolutely. Yeah, it's supposed to be quite good. I heard it's quite good, and they've put a fair bit of effort into it. I suppose there's so many commemorations going on around now, and in terms of the World War One commemorations, and then planning for 1916, and the Lusitania came in amongst that as well with the Irish connection. So yeah, it should be good. And my auntie then, Trudy, who lives in England, she's going over on a special cruise, going out tomorrow morning from the south coast of England over to France and then back over across the where the Lusitania lies, and they'll be in Cove for the special commemoration ceremonies on the 7th of May later in the week. So I might go down and try and see them there for that.
Definitely. Really interesting, Damien. Thanks for chatting to us this Saturday morning. It's very appreciated.
Thank you very much.
Appreciated. Take care. That's Damien Tiernan there, who is RT's Southeast correspondent. His great-grandfather died on the Lusitania. It was an amazing ship at the time. It was able to cross from here to America in under 5 days 100 years ago, which made the United States very accessible, of course, if you could afford the ticket, which I'd imagine, compared to what you'd be earning at that time, would be quite a lot of your income. Pupils from second to sixth classes at St. Mary's National School have wrote lyrics to and composed and performed a song entitled Malin Head. It's part of their music curriculum to promote Malin Head as a tourist destination. I'm joined on the line now by Deputy Principal of St. Mary's, Julianne Devlin. A very good morning to you, Julianne.
Oh, good morning.
Something of an undertaking. This video is available on YouTube, and hopefully we're going to hear it a little bit later on. But first and foremost, tell us why you came up with this idea, or why the students did.
Well, it was really by accident. It was second class to sixth class pupils. I'm a class teacher in the school. I teach the middle classes, but we have the second class to sixth class all together then with the music. So as a large group, as part of the school curriculum, the music curriculum, we composed a song. Now, we would compose songs most years. We had lovely songs at Christmas time and so on, you know, Jolly Santa and that. But this song just happened to be about Malinhead, an idea which the children came up with themselves. And they wrote the words, like a poem first, composed the music around it, you know, adding the different instruments as part of the music curriculum. But just when it was all completed, then the children decided, gosh, this is something maybe that we could use, you know, to advertise our Malinhead as a local area. It's the Students' Council. Most schools now might have a Students' Council. So the Students' Council is basically made up of a few children, two children from each class, and they would have organised it themselves. They would have contacted local man Ali, who was able to help us out with finding someone to record the song and so on. And it really, really started from there. So it just started really as a normal class music project, you know.
People can be critical of the internet, particularly as it relates to children, but it's amazing to how useful a tool it could be. You know, going back 10 or 15 years, as you mentioned, the students may well have done this, but yes, what would be the audience? And now we've the likes of YouTube, where the thanks, as you mentioned, to local help, you can get a recording and get it up online and get it to that much wider audience, which I'd imagine is a superb buzz for the children involved and the teachers.
Yes, they were extremely excited. It's just a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, really, for children of that age. And I do feel sorry for children that might have been here, you know, a couple of years ago that had done exactly the same thing as part of their music curriculum, but it just ended up just being a normal classroom project and went nowhere from there. And as you say, a few years ago, it wouldn't have been an option to do something like this. And it was done so easily. You know, everything's digital now. Everything, it can just be done so easy, just, you know, creating your Google account and creating a YouTube channel and just putting it up from there.
And also, it's nice, isn't it, too, because it gives the children or strengthens their sort of sense of pride in their local area. I'm sure it's already there, but, you know, when you perhaps can work towards attracting more attention to it, it gives you that extra sense of importance.
It certainly does. They would be very familiar with all. Like, Malinhead really is a lovely tourist area. It's got lovely features and well-known landmarks and even the natural beauty of the area. I'm originally from Malinhead myself. And the pupils, this was their idea, to come up with the idea of Malinhead as a song to talk about the natural features and the landmarks and so on. So they are definitely proud of their area, and they knew what they were talking about, because when we're trying to compose a poem, that's, you know, initially that's how we started the song. They knew their area, they knew all the different various landmarks, and having to rhyme it on top of that, you know, to make it into a song.
And then there's that teamwork aspect to it, because they have to work together, of course.
Oh, they have to work together. Like, just creating the lyrics alone to make sure that, you know, that they rhyme and that we would be able to place music to it's hard. And then, of course, you've got adding the instruments on top of that. Like, there was about 39 pupils altogether involved in this. So we have all the pupils singing, and there's about 20 playing instruments. We've got guitars, the button accordions, fiddles, desk and recorders. Then there's the percussion instruments. We've got bongos and xylophones. So putting that all together, it had a lot of practice, a lot of work went into it, certainly. But the children are delighted with it. They really enjoyed the experience of the recording, and they're just delighted at the prospect that they can help their community in promoting Malinhead as an area.
And I'm sure it'll inspire students right across the county. So, Miss Devlin, part of the music curriculum, is it A's all round?
It is, yeah. The music. well, I mean, we play recorder. All students from second class to sixth class get the opportunity to learn the recorder when they're at the school, and that is learning how to read music. So they're learning how to read the music, but in addition to that, we try and let them take in whatever instruments they might be learning outside school too, to apply to different settings. And I think it really influences the other children who are also doing the music that they will want to learn instruments or they will want to practice more.
Well,
or,
it's great that it's not such a linear approach because, let's face it, part of music is expression and creation, and that's what you're harnessing here.
It's true. We do have a lovely curriculum in place at the minute, anyway, for music. You know, it goes from the reading of music, which would be covered by the recording, creating songs and composing. You can have a lot of fun with music, but of course there's a lot of hard work in it too, because you need the children to practice if they have to proceed in order to get to a stage where you can create something like this. And they're extremely hard-working bunch of kids, I have to say. They worked very, very hard, very dedicated, and if they hadn't practiced themselves, they wouldn't have been able to create this.
And we're going to listen to it shortly. Is this the first radio play of Malinhead?
This is the first radio play of it, and we are delighted to get the opportunity. Thank you very much.
Absolutely fantastic. Deputy Principal Julianne Devon, thank you so much for joining us on the Weekend Edition.
Thank you very much.
And so now we can hear a bit of Malinhead, composed and created by the pupils from second to sixth classes at St. Mary's National School.
Go, isn't that fantastic? Fair play to the second 6 years class at St. Mary's National School there.